This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me from the studios of Radio IQ in Charlottesville, Virginia, is Albert Louis Zambone, and he's the author of a new biography of Daniel Morgan, and it's entitled Daniel Morgan, A Revolutionary Life. Al, welcome to the Journal.
Walter, thanks so much. It's a great honor, actually.
I almost don't know where to begin. There's so much to talk about Morgan, but it's because everybody in South Carolina says cowpens, cowpens, cowpens. Mm-hmm. But he was only here about a month or two.
Yeah. He was only in the Carolinas, I think, about 4 months total. Yeah. And he was across the border in a sort of smash and grab raid, really, to the upcountry, the backcountry for a month.
Well, when you say this is a revolutionary life, you're really talking about a complete biography of the man before, during, and after the revolution. The revolution is just part of the story. So why don't we start at the beginning? Because folks in South Carolina, they identify with cowpens. There's a big statue of him in Spartanburg. So let's talk about Daniel Morgan, the man, and why did you decide to write this story?
Well, it turns out the general has been occupying a rent-free space in my head for decades. I think I read Burke Davis' Heroes of the American Revolution. I can see the book in front of me. I must be in my parents' attic. And he featured in it, and I was entranced. He was like Daniel Boone or Davy Crockett, but better. And I think my mother made me a hunting shirt when I was then in fifth grade for Halloween. And I went as Daniel Morgan and was deeply disgusted to find out that none of my all-knowing adults knew who Daniel Morgan was. So I've been waiting about 40 years to set it right. But then lo and behold, about 2 years ago at a faculty gathering, my agent texted me and said, would you be interested in writing an autobiography of Daniel Morgan? And so I thought to myself, well, Roger, I'll spare you the backstory and I'll just say yes. And so that was the pre-book story to get me ready to write this book.
Let's talk about how you define revolutionary. You say a revolutionary life, and again, people immediately think about the war. But
well, yeah, there's. When I thought about Daniel Morgan's life, one of the first things that fascinated me was the utter change of state of his own personal life. This is a man who began his recorded history or history in his neighbor's memory as a homeless boy walking into what would become Winchester, Virginia in 1753, and then ended his life with a Congressional Gold Medal back when that meant something, with a Brigadier General in the Continental Army, Major General in the Virginia Militia, and a congressman for one term, an avowed anti-Jeffersonian, and the owner of at least 125,000 acres of land.
Okay, we'll get to that.
Yeah, we'll get to that. But an immense tens of thousands of acres of land, and someone else needs to track down all the details. That's one of my misgivings about the book, is that I was not able to track down all the details of that ownership. But immense amounts of Western land when he died. He died, you know, as so many did. He died very land rich, but cash poor, immediate possessions poor. But nonetheless, a tremendous distance from how he had begun his life. And so that was revolutionary. It was revolutionary also in that he did return to the starting point. He always returned to Winchester, Virginia. And sort of another breakthrough in looking back at the superb biography that Don Higginbotham wrote of him when Higginbotham was in his mid-20s. I realized that so much, basically backcountry studies had been created in the meantime, the social history of the southern backcountry, and that there was much to talk about Morgan as an exemplar of someone from the southern backcountry. And so all these things came together in my head as a revolutionary life, in addition to, of course, being an ardent and militant revolutionary himself.
All right. Well, let's talk about the young boy. He appears in Winchester, Virginia. Did he come down the Great Wagon Road from somewhere?
Yes, he did. One of the few things he said about his life prior to Winchester was that he said that his parents had come from Wales. They had come to the Delaware Valley in the 1720s. And then he had an argument with his father, and he left home, and he had started walking. He had spent about 3 weeks in Carlisle in the winter. And then walked across Potomac, showed up in Winchester, and got a job and never left, really, except to go fight. So that was as much as he ever shared about his origins.
Well, that first job was digging stumps, right?
Yeah, the worst possible job. And then from there, he quickly went on to running a sawmill and then being a teamster of a wagon.
I just think people would be fascinated. Let's go into a little bit more detail of that.
Sure.
First of all, digging stumps today, you got some TNT or you got your backhoe and it's whatever.
Yeah.
But we're talking about, you know, almost primeval forest.
Yes. Absolutely. Imagine where he was in the lower Shenandoah was almost certainly first growth forest. And so he's got these massive stumps of oak that he has to then dig out, pickaxe out, or grub hoe. I'm not sure of that. Use a lever. Hopefully he had a team of oxen to tow on him and pull it out. But they were turning that land into wheatland in the limestone country of the lower Shenandoah. So that was his job. It's a heck of a job.
Well, he always seemed to put something aside so he could make the next step up.
He seems to have done that. He was certainly we're fortunate enough to have his records of purchases in the local store for a couple of years. And the Clements Library at Michigan also, thankfully, has preserved his tailor bill from 73 to 75, which is outrageous. I don't think that in 1762 that many people then or even now have 35 pairs of socks, but he did buy 35 pairs of socks. He bought all sorts of stuff. But yet, at the same time, he seems to have been setting aside money and continually investing in local land such that by the middle of the 1760s, he was a freeholder, and was able to vote. So that was, he made a step which many, many, many white Virginians did not make. He had moved from being a tenant to a freeholder.
He always referred to himself as an old wagoneer.
He loved, in what we have, the memories that people have of him, he loved referring to himself as an old wagoneer. That was certainly part of his self-image, that he was a man who knew his way around a team of horses and around sort of a proto-Conestoga wagon of the mid-18th century. I think part of that, too, is he knew his way around the backcountry. He knew his way, he knew his routes to particularly Falmouth and Rappahannock, the ports where the Scottish factors were buying and selling tobacco and then in turn selling goods from Britain and Europe to the Virginia planters and to the people of the backcountry who would send their pack horses up the wagon road from the Carolinas and from what would become Kentucky. So he knows, he has those commercial connections from an early time. As I say somewhere, he believed in internal improvements before anyone else believed in internal improvements because he knew the nature of how difficult it was to get goods back and forth through the British colonies as then was.
So he's a landholder. Beginning to take part in the civic activity, voting.
Yes. He's a slave owner. This from at least from 1767, 68. And he is voting. He's on juries, which is, you know, deeply ironic since of the number of times he had appeared in front of juries earlier in his life.
Why?
Burning down a barn. He was, I should say, like Big Julie of East Cicero, Illinois, in Guys and Dolls, he had a clean record, many indictments and no convictions. He was actually held, charmingly enough, the clerk's office in the Frederick County Court in Virginia still has the door of the original jail. So when I go to do research on Dan Moore, you can see the door behind which he was confined waiting trial. He was also accused of stealing a horse. There was a civil suit. He was clear to that.
That's pretty serious.
It was, but it was only a civil suit, which is curious. There's a story there. Also, lots of assault and battery. He got in a lot of fights. Most of them were the sort of bare-knuckle boxing of the backcountry. But some people, in the end, sued him for it. These were the sort of things that he appeared before court. Also, for debt, as he increases in property, like Carolinians and Virginians of the age, everyone was in debt. And so when a loan was called in, you were sued for it. That wasn't personal. It was just business. So he appears a lot for debt suits.
And he's in the militia.
He's in the militia. He's in the French Indian War. He goes from receiving 500 lashes for striking a British officer. He goes to almost immediately to being an ensign in the Virginia Rangers, which is an extraordinarily irregular and unprofessional corps, which gets 24-year-old George Washington's ire no end. From there, he eventually, as he ascends in offices within the county, He becomes lieutenant and then a captain of militia by 1774.
How does he feel about the coming revolution, the political debate? We know later on he's not a friend of Thomas Jefferson, but he was a big law and order man. Was that true back before the revolution?
Well, it is ironic, isn't it, that the man who so often in court should be a law and order man, but he is a man who does prize order and discipline, certainly as a commander of men. He almost prizes it too much. Certainly his more freewheeling subordinates think so. He has a very short set of autobiographical remarks from, I think, written probably in the middle point of the war, about 1780. It's unclear to me to whom he was writing it. Harry Lee uses it for his memoirs years later, and it kicks around various people's archives. He, as he describes it, it's a question of honor. On the way back from Dunmore's War, a war against the Shawnee in the Ohio Valley, he and those officers who had participated in Dunmore's War signed a pledge of pledging their honor to support the citizens of Boston and of Massachusetts against any further royal incursions and attempts to subjugate the people of Massachusetts. After Lexington and Concord, therefore, his honor is implicated. So it's a very revolutionary moment when a homeless boy become a landowner can say, well, my honor is pledged to this, and I must go assist. And indeed, he does. He's fortunate enough that his friends and patrons are running the Committee of Safety for Frederick County. The man who married him, business partner, Isaac Zane, and military superior Angus MacDonald, they're all on the Committee of Safety, and they all appoint him to command a Continental Company of Riflemen, which he then leads to Boston.
So he goes from militiaman to a Continental at the start.
Very seamless. It's very murky, but the first, there are three military actions the Congress takes in June of 75. One is they adopt the New England Army that's now besieging Boston after Lexington, Concord, and Bunker Hill. They appoint Washington to command of the Continental Army. And then they raise up these companies of riflemen from Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia. And Morgan becomes captain of one of the companies from Virginia.
When does he fight his first battle in the Revolution?
His first battle, if we dismiss with, as soon as he arrives after a remarkably short march, his men move somewhere between 22 to 30 miles a day, get from Winchester to Boston. There's a great deal of skirmishing and picket duty, basically shooting British soldiers who pop up above the rampart. This becomes very boring for Morgan and tedious for Washington. They're wasting powder and ball. And Morgan volunteers for the opportunity to march through the Maine woods in a secret attack at Quebec City. And his first real action of the Revolution is the ill-fated assault on Quebec City in New Year's Eve of 1775.
All right, but he's got a bunch of Shenandoah Valley riflemen with him. That's an important part of the story, right?
It is a very important part of the story. It's interesting to think about who they are. It took me a while to figure this out, but the Shenandoah Valley by this time is not the edge of the frontier. These are probably, some of them might have been long hunters who've done the long hunt in Kentucky and or in the Ohio Valley. But there are many more such men in the Pennsylvania regiments, which comes from the Forks of the Ohio and Bedford County, all the parts of Pennsylvania that are now on the other side of the Appalachians. Shenandoah, the last Indian attack, I think the last death from an Indian raid is 1766, 1768. If you assume these young men are somewhere between 17 and 24, which is the assumption you should make about most armies, then they've just grown up outside of that. And they're not really long hunters. They're winter hunters. They're market hunters. This is described by a fellow who grew up in that generation of when the harvest is taken up, these guys go up into the hills and they hunt deer for the skins in the classic backcountry, a way of raising extra income. So they are young men who are used to hunting deer, and it's actually a challenge to take those young men used to hunting deer and turning them into soldiers, which is not the same thing.
This is where we come to Morgan, the disciplinarian.
Yeah.
He's always remembered, particularly for the night before Calpans, how he goes from campfire to campfire and speaks to the boys and gives them a pep talk. But there was another side of him as Morgan, the commander, in terms of order.
Yeah. John Joseph Henry, who's a remarkable young man, he was 16 at the time, when he went through the Maine woods, one of the great, I think, one of the great American marches, now completely unknown, against tremendous odds of nature, marching through a hurricane, marching across the north woods of Maine and down the rapids, through the rapids of the Canadian rivers to get to Quebec City. Henry remembers Morgan as commanding, stentorian voice. He says he looked like Belisarius, the Byzantine general, which I have no idea what that means, how Henry knew that. But anyway, the idea is that he's commanding, he's incredibly martial, he's a passion for order and discipline. He almost strikes a soldier with a stick of firewood for discharging his rifle rather than drawing the charge and therefore giving away position to any enemy scouts. He insists that his Virginians, the Pennsylvanians dispose of their heavy boats earlier on in the march. He insists the Virginians continue to carry their bateau across the height of the land, the peak of the Appalachians in the Maine woods, even though their shoulders by this time are worn bloody and the flesh is ragged from the weight of those boats. He insists that they continue to carry them. Yet at the same time, he has this deep, what we would call emotional intelligence, this deep affection for those to whom he believes are good soldiers. Affection, which I think that he certainly would have called love. In the 18th century, his passions are free and yet directed towards those who are worthy of them.
Well, Quebec City was not a very successful campaign.
No, it was a terrible failure. And in fact, the estimates are that of the 96 men he took from the Shenandoah, I think something like 25 return. Most of those are not combat deaths; they're deaths of smallpox while in captivity. Morgan and his soldiers are in prison until June of July of 1776.
And they are imprisoned in Quebec City?
Yeah, they're imprisoned in the basically seminaries of Quebec, which are these large, impressive buildings to this day, where the French priests were trained to go off and be missionaries to the natives, there's essentially a monastery and there's also a nunnery, and so the soldiers are spread about amongst those places and kept in confinement there.
Later on, during the Revolution, and actually after the Revolution, he reminds folks, "Yes, I've been a POW. I know what it was like."
Yeah, he does. He also still, his friendships remain strong to people who suffered through that with him. And he's surrounded up until the end of the war by people who had endured that with him. He's also remains very strong in his friendship to Benedict Arnold. Even after Benedict Arnold has gone over to the British, he still calls him my old friend in a letter to Jefferson. And I don't think he's being sarcastic. I'm not sure Morgan really could be sarcastic. I think he would have hung Arnold, but he still would have loved him for being a fellow sufferer and for showing that he was made of the right stuff in that march through the Maine woods.
After he's exchanged and he's back home, then what?
Washington has decided that Morgan is the right material from which the future officer corps of the Continental Army should be made. He is engaged in the early 1777 after the successes at Trenton and Princeton. Washington's engaged in reforming the army into something that will last for the duration of the war. Up until then, it's been 2 years of ad hocery. So now he's trying to have regular regiments, stable regimental system, stable regimental command. He also wants a corps of light infantry. So he elevates Morgan from captain to colonel in one go. Nice way of gaining rank.
Ooh, that's yes.
Yeah. And then he makes him both commander of the 11th Virginia line, but he also makes him commander of the Corps of Riflemen, which is really an ad hoc temporary unit of all riflemen taken from Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia regiments of the line. Some regiments, the 8th Virginia, had gone to Charleston to defend it in 76, and under Peter Muhlenberg, they had been outfitted completely with rifles. Muhlenberg decided that was a waste of time. A lot of his men didn't know how to use them. So what you've got in April, May, and June is people are shuffling around, soldiers from unit to unit, and shuffling around rifles as well, trying to collect every rifle to provide Morgan's new corps of riflemen with the right instruments. So there's a great, as after Morgan's release from parole, there's a great deal of bureaucratic to-ing and fro-ing and trying to set things in an orderly train for the rest of the foreseeable future at the time.
Well, now, if he was on parole, he shouldn't have taken back up, right, didn't he?
Well, that was, in fact, Washington tells Congress he wants to appoint Morgan to this position but keep it secret because he's still on parole. Morgan's off parole, I think, by February of 1777, March of 1777. And he has a great deal of difficulty, as everyone did after that point, a great deal of difficulty in raising sufficient soldiers for the 11th Virginia, and then also to other soldiers from other units to find the riflemen in them. The rage militaire, as Charles Royster called it, that has faded away. There's no longer the enthusiasm for the cause that there had been in 1775. And recruiting is very difficult, and Morgan is very late in getting up to the encampments in New Jersey because of that.
We can now move on to Saratoga.
Sure. So Saratoga, Washington is contemplating in summer of 77, I think, his most difficult situation during the entire war. He's envisioning a sort of nutcracker is about to catch him. John Burgoyne is moving with an army out of Canada down the lakes, Lake Champlain, Lake George, then down to the Hudson Valley. And it's Washington's assumption that William Howe, commanding the main British army centered upon New York City, will move up the Hudson Valley to join Burgoyne and catch Washington's army. And another army now led by Horatio Gates will catch them between these two jaws of the Nutcracker. Amazingly enough, Howe boards ships in New York Harbor and disappears. Washington thinks this is all enormous ruse. It's not until late July that he realizes that Howe is heading south, and it's not until August that he realizes that Howe has sailed up the Chesapeake and apparently intends to attack Philadelphia. So now he has to keep his forces divided and defend Philadelphia and also defend the Hudson Valley. So he in an odd spirit of self-sacrifice, decides to send Morgan north to join Gates and to fight Burgoyne's army. And Morgan marches north with his men. They take boats up to Albany, march up to what's now Stillwater, New York, to Bemis Heights, a sort of plateau overlooking the Hudson. And he takes up positions with the army there under Benedict Arnold's immediate command. And there over 3 weeks in late September and October are fought the battle, what we call the Battle of Saratoga. They're actually sort of two discrete battles, and with some very important maneuvering and work by Morgan before and in between them and afterwards.
Well, you refer to him as the architect of victory. Now, Benedict Arnold and his fans would strenuously object.
Yeah, I try not to. I have to go back and look at that. I've resisted the temptation, which seems perennial for any biographer, to say my woman is the most important thing in this period. There are many architects of victory at Saratoga. I wouldn't discount anyone. I think Horatio Gates is key to victory. He picked the right place. He supplied people. He was able to put together a really enormously large army by American Revolution standards to oppose Burgoyne. Benedict Arnold is unquestionably a great battlefield commander. Morgan, however, it's hard for me to imagine how Saratoga would have played out without Morgan and his corps there. They do provide an essential ability. They're an essential tool in Arnold and Gates's toolbox with which to oppose Burgoyne.
And, of course, the tool his men used was the rifle.
Yes.
Morgan did not follow the rules of warfare where you weren't supposed to take out the officers, but he had his men pick out the officers and senior non-commissioned officers, which created chaos in the British ranks.
And artillerymen and artillery horses. Those were also very valuable, valid targets as far as he was concerned. And you can see the success as the battles go on, there's one great story about just as a cow pens, apparently this happened a lot, an American officer pole vaulting onto a top of a artillery piece, which has been left behind because there's nothing to drag it. There are no horses to drag it. And there are no artillerymen left to serve it either. They've all been killed or wounded.
Al, we need to pause for a moment, let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm speaking with Albert Louis Zambon about his biography of Daniel Morgan, entitled Daniel Morgan, A Revolutionary Life. Al, before that break, we had finished the Battle of Saratoga. Morgan is looking, he's ambitious. There's nothing wrong with being ambitious, but he doesn't think he's getting the recognition that he deserves.
No, he doesn't. It's interesting to compare the cultural attitudes of, say, modern American soldiers with those in the 18th century, and the disjunction is such that it's often hard, I think, for modern Americans to get back in the mentality of the 18th century. You know, modern American soldiers will say, "Well, gosh, the medal, no big deal. It's for my buddies. I don't think a big deal of it." Morgan would think that was just crazy. I mean, he wanted medals, he wanted honor, he wanted glory, he wanted advancement. And he was not alone in the Continental Army. These men wanted to have their honor and glory and advancement, and that was something real and important to them, and culturally important to them. So by 1779, by this time, the Corps of Riflemen has been disbanded. Its component units as companies have been distributed hither and yon by Washington. And he's now Washington's now creating a Corps of Light Infantry, which will, in the British sense, be each regiment of the American Continental Line will have a company or so of light infantry in it, which will be then grouped together during campaign or for special uses. Morgan believes that in addition to continuing to command a Virginia regiment, he should be promoted to brigadier general. And be given the command of this Corps of Light Infantry. After all, his record speaks for itself. There's no one else who has his experience using light troops. And that's just not going to happen because of the politics of the Continental Army. Washington cannot make another Virginian brigadier general. They have enough brigadier generals already. And Morgan doesn't have the rank as a colonel to be head of the Corps of Light Infantry. And so it goes to Anthony Wayne, whose record is not great compared to Morgan's.
Yeah. Known in history as Mad Anthony Wayne.
Yeah.
For his exploits in Ohio later on. Okay.
That's right. But up to that point, his greatest exploit as an independent commander had been getting his men massacred by the bayonet at Paoli. He's a much better commander than that shows, but in 1779, that's what he's known for.
You mentioned honor was very important to Morgan, so he doesn't get the command he wants. Then what does he do?
He resigns. He resigns in disgust. He says, "I cheerfully obeyed every order I received. I with pleasure underwent every hardship, not doubting but my faithfulness would recommend me to my country and my merits meet with their just reward." But they haven't. And so, therefore, so dishonored, he feels he is compelled to leave the Army.
All right. So he goes back home to Winchester.
Yeah, much to Washington's disgust. If Washington had his way, he never would have made it to Brigadier General. He never would have made it to Cowpens, actually.
All right. Is this when he and Washington, I don't want to say part company, but hard feelings?
There are hard feelings on Washington's part, certainly. I think that it's somewhat ironic because basically the winter of 77-78, Morgan becomes an ardent Washingtonian. And in fact, I would say worships him only a little less than he will eventually the Christian God. Morgan, I do not think, understands, this is my surmise, Morgan does not understand the level of Washington's disgust with him. And some people like Richard Meade, who's one of Washington's aides, they do try to sugarcoat Washington's opinion of Morgan when they write to Morgan. So he's not, I think, completely understanding what he's done to, as Washington sees it, is destructive to the system of officers in the Army.
In the middle of the war, I didn't get what I wanted, so I'm taking my ball and I'm going home.
Yeah, of course, he's not unusual in that.
No, I know. I know.
It's we have an idea but the people who were able to stay, and I just met someone on Monday night whose ancestor was in the war for the duration. They were a lieutenant or a captain, and they probably had nothing much to go back home to. If they got paid, it was probably enough. It was, but if you're a colonel or a general with property, as Morgan has, very few of them managed to make it for the duration. Washington, Nathaniel Greene, most of others, they go in and out of the Army in one way or the other. So we have a somewhat mistaken idea of patriotism being the only natural fuel for an officer in the Continental Army. A lot of them say, well, that's, you know, patriotism is great, but what about my wife and kids? What about my farmland? Who's taking care of that?
How long does he stay back home in the Shenandoah Valley?
About a year. In fact, it's September of 1780 that he leaves, but he's there for just over a year.
In the meantime, by September 1780, a lot of things is happening down south. George Washington isn't there. And of course, a lot of things are happening in South Carolina. And the British occupy Charleston.
Yes.
Cornwallis begins his great Southern strategy of rolling up the Carolinas to Virginia. Tarleton, who's not the only one, Tarleton, Kruger, and a few others, Weems, are loosed on the native population.
Mm-hmm. And Ferguson begins to create a loyalist militia, which always seems to me one of the most crucial moments, too, in the Southern strategy.
Yeah, but at the same time, Ferguson is being successful, particularly in the real backcountry, beyond what you think of York and places like that. You've got a rising rebellion beginning in late June with a whole string of skirmishes and battles.
Yes.
And except for two biggies, Camden and Fishing Creek, they are partisan or patriot victories.
Yes.
Not Continental Army victories, because
no.
Horatio Gates has done that. And you're very kind to Horatio Gates, I must say.
Well, I tried to. I probably have had a lot of antipathy to Horatio Gates. And I was trying to give everyone their due. I did not, as I said earlier, I did not want to make this one of those biographies where
I know,
you know,
I know.
Everyone else has to be bad.
Al, I'm just ribbing you. I mean,
yeah, all right. I felt awkward doing it. I'll tell you that. That's
well. I mean, you know, Granny Gates.
Yeah.
Galloper Gates.
Hamilton, my favorite line, shows unparalleled activity for a man of his age to ride so far. there are those who have defended that rather precipitous, really actually an amazing ride from the field of Camden to Hillsborough. I'm not one of them. It just is a head scratching thing.
Well, and for our listeners who are not sure what we're talking about, it's after the Battle of Camden, which was a military disaster, in large part thanks to Thomas Sumter and Horatio Gates. The commanding general jumps on his horse, dashes to Charlotte, changes horses, and goes further. So that's where he gets the name Galloper Gates. And also, Granny Gates was clearly a slam at his manhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, but it's because of Gates that Morgan is back in the Army.
Yeah, it's because of Gates. Gates is Morgan's pretty close neighbor. They're both convivial fellows. They like drinking rum, no doubt, together. And Gates, when he's summoned south after to replace Benjamin Lincoln, who's been captured at Charlestown, Gates visits Morgan quickly, says he'll do what he can to get him the rank of brigadier general, and promises that he'll give him command of the flying army, the light troops of the Southern Army. Morgan doesn't leave immediately. He wants to get the commission in his hand before heading south. There are many cinematic moments in Morgan's life. My favorite is, I think, what I imagine is a true classic American image of when he gets the news of Camden. He saddles up. He takes a spare horse. He sells that in Richmond to pay for his expenses. And he rides off. He rides south. He rides south to the scene of the disaster. He's going to go do what he can.
And he actually meets up with Gates in Charlotte, right?
Yeah.
Or near Charlotte.
I believe he rides in, I think it's Hillsboro first.
Hillsboro first.
Is still in Hillsboro, yeah. Okay. But then they start to creep their way down back towards Charlotte. And it's from Charlotte that he does most of his activities are conducted out of Charlotte, and really, until Cornwallis begins the pursuit in January.
Okay. All right. But he no sooner has married up with Gates when Gates is relieved and replaced by Nathaniel Greene.
Yes. And what does Otho Williams call on the most delicate and interesting occasion? I believe, according to Williams, Gates did not realize this is going to happen until Greene shows up. But then Gates is relieved. Greene takes command. And two of the most, certainly, you would think, opposite personalities of the American Revolution, Nathaniel Greene and Daniel Morgan, then turn out to be perfectly suited to each other. Salt and pepper, bacon and eggs are wonderful.
Hey, you've got a silk-stocking, well-educated Quaker, and I don't want to say Morgan semi-literate. He can read and write by this time, but
yes.
Rather rough-hewn, hard-drinking Shenandoah Valley backcountryman, and yet in terms of military tactics and strategy, it's a perfect mesh. It's the way they think.
It is beautiful. I mean, you read their letters, you can see them meshing on some deeper level. It helps that they both have the same opinion of Thomas Sumter. Everyone can unite in their hatred of Thomas Sumter, apparently. There's that. But they complement each other perfectly. Both Greene and Morgan, as I've thought about it, I don't think there are any commanders in all of American history who have had such good luck in their subordinates. It was really impossible for a Continental Army officer to pick and choose subordinates in the way that one could in later wars. This sort of just happened for them, but they had Otho Williams, they had William Washington, eventually Harry Lee. They've got the partisan, they've got Andrew Pickens showing up from out of nowhere, as our mutual friend Rod Andrew has described. They've got Francis Marion. It goes on and on. They're just so blessed in the people that are around them. John Eager Howard. We could go on.
And you've actually got lesser-known partisans as well who maybe participate with a larger group, but who are all scattered all over New Acquisition District, Spartan District, who, whether they're actually with him or not, can become the eyes and ears of the Army.
Absolutely, and which is always key to both the pre- and post-battle of Camden. That's absolutely key. And we should also mention there are men coming out of Virginia who are going there because Morgan's there. Frank Triplett, who commands Virginia troops at Cowpens. Morgan's known him since the 1750s. Sam Houston Sr. out of Rockbridge County. We could go on and on. These are people that know of Morgan or know Morgan, and they are all attracted to him. And Morgan is able to benefit from all of them. And to my mind, the greatest threat the Patriot cause faced was an organized loyalist force that Ferguson visioned. So with that eliminated, it gives much a greater freedom of action for someone like Morgan, who wants to then go into the backcountry and, as Greene instructs him, spirit up the people.
Okay. Greene is there, and Cornwallis has gotten word that the Southern Army is reconstituting itself or being reconstituted.
Yes. And he is, at this point, I think he moves to basically what he sees as a blocking position at Winnsboro. And he's still got his series of posts throughout the, let's say, the lower backcountry and then the backcountry. And then Greene decides to do what everyone says not to do, which is split his forces. He'll send Morgan into the backcountry with the flying army, the light troops, the preponderance of his cavalry, and he will move down to Traws, which is an area which has not been. This is all about where things have been foraged, where there's feed, and particularly for horses. And he will send Morgan into the backcountry. He will go to Traws. It hasn't been that picked over yet. And he will then wait to see what Cornwallis will do. If Cornwallis moves to block Greene from going towards Charlestown, then Morgan can do what he likes in the backcountry. If he moves his force towards Morgan, then Greene can move towards Charlestown. And if he divides his force, then they're just where they are right now. That's the thinking. And it turns out to be accurate.
And then Cornwallis does exactly what Greene hoped he would do, and that is he divides his force.
Mm-hmm. In the best possible way. He splits off Tarleton with about 900 to 1,000 British troops, the British Legion, which is composed of Northern Loyalists and American deserters from the Siege of Charleston. Also some Loyalists, about 50 to 100 Loyalists, local Loyalists, who can provide him with knowledge of what the ground is like and what the terrain is like, where the mills are, where the fords are, and so on. Meanwhile, Cornwallis stays planted at Winnsboro. He doesn't make a move towards Greene. So Greene can continue to replenish his army in Shiraz. And now Morgan is looking at a fight. He is hindered by the fact that the militia who are joining him all have horses. Now, this makes them superb for their own mode of insurgent warfare. They can ride in, strike, ride off. But for the campaign that Morgan is envisioning, the horses are another mouth to feed, and worse than that, they're a 15 to 20 pounds of hay a day per horse mouth to feed. It's not a problem that Morgan can solve. It's not a problem Tarleton can solve either. He has the same problem. So he's moving into sort of a logistics desert and moving into I don't think this is Morgan's intention. This is probably crediting it with too much, but he's moving into a sort of logistics trap. In fact, Tarleton's much more cautious than we give him credit for. He does pause at least once to get replenishment, build up his supplies before he goes into one of those classic Tarletonian mad dashes towards victory.
Now we get to Cowpens.
We get to, yeah.
Considered, I think, still, certainly it certainly was last time I was dealing with the folks out at Leavenworth, the great tactical battle of the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Still taught.
Yes. It so, is the American cani, referring back to Hannibal's great victory in Rome, the double envelopment. It's what all those kids are always imagining that they'll perform from the first time they read about Hannibal's victory onward. And here's this illiterate, well, semi-literate by that time, this backcountry teamster who's able to do it. And yet the fact that it happens is all chance. It's a classic example of no battle plan surviving contact with the enemy, and of Eisenhower's dictum that planning is indispensable, plans are dispensable.
Luck, whatever you want to call it. You also had commanders, not just Morgan, but I think Pickens and William Washington and others, who were able to react.
Mm-hmm.
And the end result is this is the only battle of the Revolution where British regulars fled the field of battle.
Yes. You have men who are, after 5 years of war, have become true professionals, and that is enlisted and also officers. You've got the Delaware Regiment, commanded by a man no one's ever heard of, Captain Robert Kirkwood, who's in his 20s. And he's superb, and his men are superb, and they know what to do. So when things go wrong, they know how to take advantage of things going wrong to make it difficult for the people who are fighting them. Things do go wrong, and they take advantage of it. For example, the classic moment is after the first two lines of sharpshooters and then Pickens and Georgia militia, South Carolina, Georgia militia, some North Carolinians as well, after they've delivered their fires very deliberately, aiming. Two shots from the sharpshooters, three or so from the line of militia. They retreat. The third line, which is composed of Continentals and also Virginia riflemen, they resist the British onset. And at some point, some orders are mistaken, and that third line begins to retreat. Morgan arrives in quite a state. I suspect some really delicate understatement is being made by those who recall his words. And he asks essentially what in the world is going on. And John Eager Howard, who is by this time probably one of the finest professional soldiers in the Continental Line, says, "Have you ever seen any men retreat like flee in such good order?" And Morgan allows us how he has not. And he says he'll go forward and he'll pick a spot for them to make their stand. And so they are essentially, it looks as if they are, they're doing a wounded duck thing. They're drawing the enemy farther and farther after them. And in fact, they find a spot, they come to a halt, they turn, and they deliver a volley of fire directly in the face of the ragged onset of the British soldiers. And they then fire again and charge with the bayonet. And the battle starts to go distinctly against Tarleton at that moment.
I'm looking at our time, and we need to move on into the from cowpens. We could stay here for another hour and talk about cowpens. Let's look at Morgan's post-revolutionary career.
He goes about becoming a great man of the Shenandoah Valley, a grandee. He's got a big house. It's made out of stone. It's highly unusual to have a big stone house in the Shenandoah Valley before that time.
Called Saratoga, right?
Called Saratoga. He hires Hessian POWs to help build it, which is very common around Lancaster and Winchester and Charlottesville, using them as a labor force. When Lord Fairfax, the local grandee, dies, he buys all his furniture, and he has a carriage. He's set up as a gentleman with a carriage. There's no higher status than that. He also starts buying, as best as I can make out, he starts buying land certificates from soldiers.
That's not a very good thing.
Well, depends who you are. If you're a soldier that wants some money to get home, it's a pretty good deal for you. The bad thing is that everyone knows that these land certificates are being bought for cents on the dollar. The fact is that everyone is doing it. Abigail Adams is doing it. Horatio Gates is doing it. The only person who doesn't seem to be doing it is George Washington. And so Morgan does it, and that is the reason he acquires so much land in the Ohio Valley. These certificates are being given by the states in lieu of pay are to X number of acres in the Ohio Valley. And when he acquires them, he becomes a great landowner in title, if not in actual possession.
When Morgan decides to go into politics, it's surprising for a backcountry man, even one who's become a grandee in the Shenandoah Valley, to be a Federalist.
Mm. Of course, he decides this after experiencing the Whiskey Rebellion. His best friend, John Neville's house is burned down. Neville's the excise collector who's really the focus of what's called the Whiskey Rebellion. His son-in-law is John Neville's son, Presley. And so Presley and John Neville flee Pittsburgh, leaving Morgan's daughter with his grandchildren. So his family has been a target of what he sees as Jacobin outrage, and which he quickly sees then as Jeffersonian outrages. So there's that. The fact is the Valley, up until the 1860 election and beyond, was always a Federalist and then a Whig and then a Republican, semi-Republican area. The reason for that, as I see it, is that the Valley is a grain-growing area. Morgan's built a mill. He's been involved in internal improvements. He is a natural Federalist slash Whig, even before there's a Federalist Party.
He and Washington begin to reconcile.
Yeah. I believe Washington's reconciliation comes with when he sees what a good job Morgan did as virtually really as the military governor of Western Pennsylvania, ruling his own people, ruling fellow Americans. And he does a pretty good job. He is, as he usually is, very lenient towards those who have been his enemies. And I think that Washington very much approves of that stance.
But he still hadn't gotten his medal.
He doesn't get his medal. Gosh, how long is it? I think it's not until 1790, 91 that he finally gets that medal.
He finally gets the gold medal that Congress had authorized after the Battle of Cowpens.
And it's almost surprising that he got it that early. In fact, much of Morgan's correspondence from the 1780s, at least the stuff that he writes, is basically along the lines is, where the heck is my medal and when am I going to get it?
In your epilogue, you talk about the fact that Morgan has become a forgotten hero of American history. I really was fascinated. You compared this to Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett. Well, you could even say Francis Marion. But even in his hometown, Morgan was forgotten until the 1950s.
Oh, that the great Spartanburg versus Winchester contretemps. Winchester never warmed to Morgan. They knew who he had been before. And just as there's no prophet's never at ease in their hometown, and the hometown's never at ease with the prophet, Morgan was more or less in that situation. They also knew he had fathered an illegitimate son and went off on a Winchester woman sometime in the 1780s. So there was all that. And they had maybe not completely forgotten him when a group of public-spirited Spartanburg citizens, including an undertaker, showed up to remove the general's body and bring him back to a location about which I'm not sure if it's going to be right beneath the monument there in Spartanburg or if it's going to be on the Cowpens battlefield. I'm not sure they knew. So that was – and that was – that became a Life magazine photo feature, which is very amusing to look at, and what I like to think of as a great battle between Spartanburg native James Burns and Winchester native Harry Flood Byrd, two of the biggest mossback Southern Democrats of the time.
Okay. Al, do you have a copy of your book with you?
I do.
All right. If you would please just read that last paragraph to the end, I think it's a neat summation of what we've talked about today.
Yeah. His battlefields are not his greatest legacy. He did harsh and necessary work there, as he saw it, but he did not love them. He loved the lower valley of the Shenandoah, and he was one of the thousands who created it and called it home. In turn, the lower Shenandoah created him. Morgan was not his own creation. No one really is their own creation. Self-fashioning is not only an academic but a popular concept, in part because the self-made person is a concept that appeals to Americans of all times, all places, and all ideologies. We are, we like to believe, precisely who we make ourselves. But this is not quite so. We are also made by everything around us: society, culture, landscape, good fortune, providence. All these things grind at us, goad us, form us, mold us, direct us, however much we kick and bite against them. You will not find Morgan's presence beneath the walls of Quebec or at Freeman's Farm, not even at Cowpens. But if you stop for a while in the lower valley, perhaps by the signpost that gives White Post its name, by the rocky waters of the Shenandoah, or the road that runs in front of Saratoga's Long Drive, on the lawn of Soldiers' Rest, or by the stream as it runs past Burl and Morgan's Mill, there you can still look about you and see what he made and what made him.
Albert Louis Zambone, the author of Daniel Morgan, A Revolutionary Life, thank you so much for being with us today on The Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I did. I knew something about Daniel Morgan, but I did not know the story of how he rose from basically a homeless waif to the status of a Virginia planter gentleman. It's a true American story. A self-made man, but as Albert Zambone points out, his world helped make him as much as he helped make himself. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETB Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.